Hey guys, Matt here with a favor to ask. Rate and review this show, Matt Lewis and the News, on iTunes. If you like it, it's the number one most important thing you can do to help others find it, and it'd be a favor to me. Rate and review it, and I appreciate your support.
This is Andrew Breitbart, and you're listening to Matt Lewis and the News.
I got to be honest. I actually didn't know until I got this book that Eleanor Roosevelt was gay or was bisexual. I assumed it was probably true, but I didn't know that this was an established fact, or at least that the evidence heavily suggested this. But then I got this book called Eleanor and Hick, The Love Affair That Shaped a First Lady. And this is not from some fly-by-night operation. It's Penguin Random House, which I think is a pretty highly respected publishing house. So I decided to have the author Susan Quinn on, and it turns out that there's a pretty good reason why people didn't know about this. And that is because it was intentionally kept secret. All of these thousands of letters that exist by somebody who decided that we didn't need or shouldn't know this. So we talk about that, and we talk about Eleanor Roosevelt, which I think in and of itself is an interesting topic. So the book is Eleanor and Hick, and with no further ado, the podcast.
It's time for Matt Lewis and the News, featuring interviews with some of America's best thinkers, writers, and newsmakers. And now, here's Matt.
I'm Matt Lewis. This is The News, and our guest today is Susan Quinn. She's the author of Eleanor and Hick, The Love Affair That Shaped a First Lady. Susan Quinn, welcome to The News.
Glad to be here.
Great to talk with you. Now, for, I guess, my whole life, I mean, I've heard rumors or suggestions that Eleanor Roosevelt was a lesbian. I had no idea that there was definitive proof that that is the case. Am I correct that this is now beyond rumor, that this is definitive?
Well, I think so. Blanche Wieson Cook, who's the kind of biographer of Eleanor Roosevelt and is just about to come out with her third volume, definitely thinks so. There are a few doubters, but if you read these letters, there are over 3,000 letters exchanged between Eleanor and Hick that I've read all of them. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that for about 8 years, they were in love with each other. And, certainly Hick was in love with Eleanor for the rest of her life. Eleanor was probably bisexual to the extent that she was sexual at all. I think she was, you know, pretty inhibited, in terms of physical connection, but I think she had a very strong physical connection with Lorena Hickok, Hick, as everyone called her.
I assume that this relationship had something to do with FDR's affairs, and or am I wrong about that?
Oh, I think indirectly. You know, Eleanor discovered in 1918 that FDR was having an affair with Lucy Mercer, who was Eleanor's social secretary. So it couldn't have been more painful and intimate for Eleanor to learn about this. She discovered these love letters. And at that point, she and FDR agreed to stay together, but the physical relationship was pretty much over at that point. She slept on a cot in a separate bedroom. That hurt stayed with her for a very long time. And I do think that coming back, this is 1932 when FDR is elected president, coming back to Washington, which was the scene of this affair, that's where he met and had this affair with Lucy Mercer, and knowing that he might even resume his connection with her, made her really, was one of the reasons she really dreaded becoming First Lady. And along came Lorena Hickok, who was a lesbian, and who was assigned to cover her, for the AP. Hick was a top journalist, one of the very few women who made it to the top, and she was at the AP doing national stories, and she got assigned to cover Eleanor. And what began as her just trailing Eleanor everywhere and spending time with her blossomed into this love affair.
What?
And so, I think, you know, that FDR's flirtations, and it wasn't just Lucy, it was that he was always having flirtations, and maybe other affairs, you know, nothing we can prove about any of that. But that was kind of an established pattern already, and she felt very alone. And finding this woman who adored her, who thought her absolutely beautiful and magnificent, was tremendously important to her. It really, really helped her, I think, to make that transition to being First Lady.
And this wasn't some sort of a culture shock to Eleanor Roosevelt either, right? She had been around lesbians her whole life.
Yes. Yes, and that's one of the things I really develop in the book that was kind of a surprise and revelation to me. Eleanor grew up in this very wealthy but lonely mansion with her very Victorian grandmother. Both her parents had died by the time she was 10, so she was raised by this Victorian woman. And then she was sent off to Allenswood in England, which was a girls' school in England. And the woman who ran Allenswood was Mademoiselle Souvestre, who became a very important figure in her life. And Souvestre was a lesbian who had a life partner. So there was that. And there was, in the whole atmosphere of this school, as there was in a lot of girls' school, crushes, relationships. There's even a novel called Olivia, which is written about this school and describes a girl's crush on a woman who's probably Mademoiselle Sylvester. So there was all that atmosphere. And then the women, many of the women who were involved early on in democratic politics in the early days, first they were involved in suffrage, and then when suffrage came in 1920, they became very important figures in the Democratic Party, activists, and many of them were life partners. And those became Eleanor's friends. So, you know, among them, her best friends were Nan Cook and Marion Dickerman, with whom she built this cottage for herself called Valkill, which was away from the big house that where FDR and his mother reigned supreme. And she built this with her two friends, she built Valkill. And the three of them, FDR even described Valkill as a love nest. And certainly for Nan and Marion it was, and Eleanor was kind of the third in that relationship. But they were definitely a lesbian couple and life partners. So it was all around her, and it was pretty natural when Hick came along that they should fall in love.
So you mentioned that there were thousands of letters that were written.
Yeah.
How is it that this has been kept on the down low? How is it possible? I mean, even John F. Kennedy, who, you know, during his life, we didn't know about all the affairs that came out.
Yeah.
Eleanor Roosevelt is an iconic figure. Why is it that these letters have not been made public, or at least were not widely known?
Yeah. Well, I think the phrase you used, iconic figure, is one of the problems and one of the reasons. You know, she has been so adored and idealized. And I have to say, when I started working on this book, you know, everybody is talking to me about, oh, my mother adored Eleanor, or I met her when I was a little girl. You know, everybody, it seems like in the world, knew and admired Eleanor. So when these letters came out, actually what happened was that Eleanor gave Lorena both sides of the correspondence with the idea that Hick might eventually write a biography. And so Hick had these letters, 3,300 and something letters, even more actually, went through them, destroyed a few, and gave the rest to the Roosevelt Library. And she died in 68, and the letters, she stipulated that the letters could be opened in 78, 10 years after her death. So they were. But the woman who opened them was a woman named Doris Faber, who was absolutely shocked and appalled. She said, can any reasonable person deny that these are love letters? And she said, she asked the librarians at FDR Library to lock them back up, because she was so appalled that this, in, about this fact that Eleanor had this lesbian relationship. So then she wrote a book, and the book, which came out in 1980, really, really downplayed the passionate part of the relationship and suggested even that Lorena Hickok had allowed the letters to be seen because she wanted posthumous fame for herself, that she was out for her own glory and that she was exploiting the relationship and so on and so on. So the underlying, the book, it's not bad in a lot of ways, this Doris Faber book, I have to say, but it really denies the tremendous importance and the passion of the relationship. So that was published in 1980. And since then, the letters have come out in publication, and other people have written about it and around it, you know, and even the Roosevelt series, the big PBS series, touched on it and said that there was controversy, which is what people usually say. There was clearly, in this changed atmosphere that we're in now, an opportunity to revisit it and to really celebrate this relationship and to look at how important it was to both women, and really how it did shape Eleanor's style and all the choices that she made as really, you know, a unique first lady, probably for all time.
So I want to ask you about this Doris Faber, who kept this information essentially concealed. Was she personally repulsed by this idea, or was she attempting to save Eleanor Roosevelt's image in an era when she felt that this might tarnish that reputation and that progressive image? And then I would ask you, if the latter is the case, did you have any fear or concern about writing this book that people might resent you bringing this up?
Mm-hmm. Really very interesting questions. I think Faber was probably, she was a journalist, she'd worked for the Times, she'd written about first ladies, so I don't think she probably was not personally repelled, it might have been a mix, but I think she probably was much more concerned about Eleanor Roosevelt's reputation and her dignity, which, you know, was very important to people back then, I think I had some inhibitions when I started writing the book, and in the early drafts of the book, it had more to do, I think I was not so, I have a queer daughter, so I, you know, I have a sort of positive, all-embracing feeling about this choice. So that part I was positive about, but I think I was a little bit in awe of Eleanor as a historical figure of momentous importance. And actually, in early drafts of the book, I referred to Lorena Hickok as Hick, which is everyone called her Hick, and I referred to Eleanor Roosevelt as ER, as like FDR. And actually, my agent, who is a very good editor, also said, how come you're calling her ER? It sounds so cold and distant. And I realized that was the key. I was keeping her at arm's length in some way because I was still in awe. And when I started calling her Eleanor and talking about Eleanor and Hick as two women, that really helped me to get past that awe, which was, you know, writing about a saint is not interesting. And she wasn't a saint anyway. So that was an important step for me.
How did this relationship change Eleanor Roosevelt, and was this an important ingredient for Eleanor Roosevelt becoming the icon that she became?
It was very important for that, indeed. First of all, when Hick was the AP journalist, she got the assignment of doing a series of profiles of Eleanor Roosevelt. And by the time she did that, she knew a lot of secrets about the family. She knew the history of alcoholism. Eleanor's father had died of alcoholism. She had a brother who was also would drink himself to death a few years later. She knew her Anna, Eleanor Roosevelt's daughter, was in the middle of a messy divorce. She knew about that. But none of that was written about in the public. Oh, and of course, you know, the relationship between FDR and Eleanor, she also knew about that. So all of that was known to her. But she's also somebody who had her own secrets, because Hick was a lesbian, and of course in that time that was shameful and actually even criminal. So she wrote these stories about Eleanor, which portrayed her as a kind of rebel, the person who would buy a $10 dress off the rack, a person who would go spontaneously and have lunch at a lunch counter, a drugstore lunch counter, all of which she was, but presented her as a kind of harmless and appealing person, rebel, who said she wanted to have her own life, she wanted to earn her own money, which at that time was very unconventional. You know, women were supposed to just stand by the husband's side and support him, especially the president. So Hick created this persona, which wasn't false, it was just incomplete. And that became who Eleanor was for the public. She also brilliantly, I think, encouraged Eleanor to hold all women press conferences. And that meant that, first of all, news organizations were going to have to hire more women. And all of those women who participated in the press conferences, of course, became Eleanor's, as she said, my champions. And she would, you know, send them presents for their babies and hand out candied fruit at the press conferences and just become friendly in the way that Eleanor did with everybody. So, of course, those women wrote very positively about her and were her allies, and they also protected Hick in terms of the relationship. So all that happened, and then also in the beginning, Eleanor was writing, they decided that Eleanor should write in these letters a sort of diary of what she was doing every day. You know, first I get up and I do this, and I meet with this one and that one, and have lunch with that one. And that developed into the My Day column, which Eleanor wrote 6 days a week for her almost entire life, which became a syndicated column in which people really got to know Eleanor in this kind of homey, comfortable way. I mean, the columns could be even tedious at times, because she would just tell people about everything she was doing, you know, and she went riding and then she walked the dog and all that. But so they got to know her in a way that was unique. That was Hick's idea. And then Hick eventually had to leave AP because she knew so much, and she was always under pressure from her bosses at AP to tell more. And it just became untenable. So she left, which was in some ways a tragic decision for her in terms of her career. But she left and became this reporter for the Roosevelt administration, going out in the field and looking at relief programs and reporting back about the conditions and what real people, what life was like for these struggling families in various places, and with coal mining towns and agricultural settings, you know, with beet farmers and children picking beets, all of these sort of shocking conditions out in the field. So she would write these very, very vivid reports, because she was a very good writer. And she would write them to Harry Hopkins, who was the head of WPA, but she'd also write them to Eleanor. And one way or another, they very often got to FDR's desk. And he would actually use the anecdotes and tell people stories, and people would be very surprised that he knew about these things, because, of course, he couldn't get around himself. And so that all was part of this partnership between Eleanor and Hick, and really important in terms of influencing the New Deal.
Yeah, I'm curious about, you mentioned the AP actually wanted more information from her.
Yeah.
I'm really wondering about the journalistic ethics of this. I mean, there's like the obvious scandal, which is the First Lady's having an affair, a lesbian affair. But there's the other scandal, which is you have a journalist literally in bed with somebody they're covering, ostensibly. Would that have been seen as a huge conflict of interest at the time?
Yes. Yes. And that's why Hick quit. It was, you know, the in bed part was, yeah, I don't even know if they knew that. Maybe they did at AP, I don't know. But I think that it was more that she wasn't telling everything she knew. And there was a very kind of powerful moment that Hick writes about the night before FDR was to give his inaugural address, and he was working on it. They were at the Mayflower Hotel, and he and his son James were in one room, and Eleanor and Hick were in the adjoining bedroom. And he finished up a draft. He sent it over to Eleanor to read. She read it aloud to Hick, and this was a famous speech in which he says, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." And so Eleanor read this to Hick, and it occurred to Hick that all she would have to do at that moment was to go out and drop a nickel and repeat a few of the key phrases to her bosses at AP, and, you know, she'd have the scoop of a lifetime. But she didn't. She stayed with Eleanor. She slept in the bedroom with Eleanor that night. And that was the moment for her at which she realized that she could not go on as an AP reporter. And shortly after the inauguration, she left AP forever and just became a reporter for the New Deal, which is, of course, entirely different.
Well, you have to imagine. Like, so right now we're at the end. I was going to say, I keep wanting to say in the middle. We're at the end of a grueling presidential campaign. I'm so happy it's almost over. That has seen like all sorts of conspiracy theories and accusations. And you have to imagine if somebody had said, you know, in 1940, whatever, hey, guess what? The first lady is having a lesbian affair with a journalist who's covering the White House. Yeah. That's like tantamount to some of the, we assume, crazy things that are actually being bandied about now about Hillary Clinton, for example. I don't know. I find that interesting. That doesn't mean that things being said about Hillary are necessarily true, of course.
Right. About Eleanor, too. But there was a kind of decorum, and there were certain kind of rules that the press observed. You know, the most dramatic is that they never talked about FDR's inability to walk, or about the fact that he was, you know, his legs were no good. And had he been running now, I think he probably couldn't even be a candidate for president, because there would be all these pictures of him being lifted, you know, sort of crab-like up into the air and dropped into his car. I mean, can you imagine what Donald Trump would do with that? But that was never photographed. That was an agreement he had with his press, you know. And for Eleanor, she had these women who, as she said, are my champions, you know. So they wrote about, they didn't write about these things. But it's also true that Hick was found, there were people attacking Eleanor in various ways, you know, for something she said. And one thing about Eleanor was she hated alcohol. She hated even the smell of alcohol, because her father had been an alcoholic. Her brother was an alcoholic. It was in the family. There were uncles. I mean, it was something that she had a horror of. She never drank, really, except for sherry. So at this point, in 1932, one of the big issues was prohibition and whether it should end. And Eleanor told the press at one point, said sort of casually, talking about the fact that what she said essentially was that people had to make their own decisions about drinking and it shouldn't be regulated by government, a little bit like what Hillary now says about abortion. So drinking should be not regulated by the government. She said, in an attempt to be humorous, said, "Well, nowadays a girl going out on a date has to know how to hold her gin." Well, this was attacked by the prohibitionists as being, Eleanor Roosevelt is casual about drinking, you know, and so on. And so then Hick was, her bosses at AP wanted her to follow up on the story and write several stories about how Eleanor, you know, was very casual about drinking, and I mean, I don't know. This is not something we would worry about now, but anyway, at the time, it was a big scandal, and so Hick refused to write those stories, and she was actually fined by her bosses at AP, something they did in those days, I gather. So she was actually fined for not writing about that. So, you know, so there were ways in which she was under pressure, and the relationship came to be just impossible, an impossible one to maintain and keep her job.
What do you think it was about these two that would lead them to fall in love with one another?
Well, I think that they shared this painful childhood. That was really important. You know, Eleanor, who lost her adored father to alcoholism when she was 10, and had to live with this Victorian grandmother and a maid and a governess who were really cruel to her. It was very lonely. She was also told that she would never be a belle because she was homely. She wasn't pretty. So she was very unhappy as a child. And Lorena Hickok, who came from the completely opposite kind of situation, grew up in poverty with a father who was brutal and who beat her with barrel staves. And after her mother died and a stepmother came along, she was kicked out of the house at 14, had to go working as a maid, barely made it, was off and on making it through high school, and didn't manage college, but was self-taught and actually, I think, brilliant. So here they are from these very different backgrounds, but when they shared those with each other, there was a kind of tremendous sympathy there. I think Hick provided Eleanor with this admiration that she'd never had and this sympathy, and I think it came at a critical moment for her when she felt very vulnerable, going back to Washington, having to be First Lady and leave the things she loved, like teaching and writing, in order to be, as she said, Mrs. R. And here was someone she could confide in and completely trust. And she needed that. And Hick was always attracted to sort of women, glamorous women. She had a bunch of friends who were actors and opera stars and so on. So, and this whole world of the White House and so on was fascinating and attractive to her. So those are some of the things.
The book is Eleanor and Hick, The Love Affair That Shaped a First Lady. Susan Quinn, thank you for coming on the news.
It's been my pleasure.